The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how Japanese people's guts seem to be specialized for sushi. You mean mine's not?
Well, not if you're a North American, apparently. According to this new study, there is a big difference between the guts of people that live in North America and those that live in Japan, at least according to a sampling of a small number of people from both of these regions. The difference appears to be in a couple of enzymes that break down carbohydrates on seaweed. And as you know, Rob, seaweed is a big component of sushi. It forms the wrapping of a lot of sushi. And researchers found that there are a couple of enzymes that belong to marine bacteria. And you would imagine, of course, marine bacteria, because they're eating seaweed, among a lot of other things. But what was really unusual in this new study is researchers found a couple of these enzymes in the human gut, but only in the guts of Japanese people they looked at, not in the guts of North Americans.
And do researchers have any idea about how those enzymes got there?
Well, they have a really interesting theory, and they point to the fact that Japanese people have been eating seaweed for hundreds of years. In fact, there's tax records going back to the 8th century AD in Japan that show that seaweed was actually used as a form of payment in Japanese society. So the researchers' speculation is because Japanese people have been eating seaweed for so long, they've also been eating a lot of these microbes that feed on seaweed. And what researchers know is that when microbes come into close contact with each other, they can actually exchange genes. So the theory is that over hundreds of years, as Japanese people were swallowing these microbes that have these special enzymes for digesting seaweed, the genes for these enzymes were actually getting transferred into the normal, what researchers call gut flora. These are all the millions of bacteria, or maybe even billions of bacteria, that live in our gut and help us digest food. The idea is that some of these bacteria would have actually taken up these enzymes from these marine bacteria and incorporated it into their own genome. And you would see this happening a lot more, obviously, in Japan, where seaweed is a much more of a staple of the diet than it is in North America.
So is this enzyme something that I could get in my gut bacteria too?
Well, theoretically, Rob, if you ate a lot of these marine bacteria that contained the genes for this enzyme and these bacteria transferred that enzyme to your gut bacteria, it could happen. Probably what's happening here is a lot more complicated, something that developed potentially over hundreds of years of eating these types of food and digesting these algae, because this is probably not a very efficient process, these bacteria transferring these genes to your gut bacteria. So unlikely that if you just consumed a bunch of marine bacteria, that is going to help you out in terms of having these enzymes. But it does raise the larger question, does having these enzymes actually help us at all? I mean, we know it helps these marine bacteria because it helps them digest seaweed, but you and I can eat sushi without any problems, even though we're from North America.
Yeah. What do the Japanese get out of it?
And that's still an open question. The researchers speculate that the Japanese may be able to get more nutrients than we would be able to get out of the seaweed. So both us and a group of Japanese people would be able to digest sushi just fine. But maybe the Japanese people would have an easier time breaking down the carbohydrates in seaweed, or perhaps they would be able to break down more of the carbohydrates. So maybe they would get a little extra out of this food than we would. But again, still an open question.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from bacteria to birds, this next story is all about birds that don't like rain, even though they live in the rainforest.
How could researchers tell that they don't like rain?
Well, researchers here were studying migration patterns in a bird known as the white ruffled manakin. And this is a chickadee-sized bird that eats fruit. And this study took place in Costa Rica, where these birds live. You know, the common theory about, you know, bird migrations is that birds will migrate to where the food is. But in this new study, the researchers found out that that may be true to some extent, but the birds also seem to be migrating because they just don't like getting rained on.
So they're migrating out of the rainforest?
No, actually, they're migrating to a lower elevation. At the lower elevations in the rainforest, this particular rainforest, you tend to have less rain. And what the researchers did in this study was they tracked a group of these white ruffed manakins from mid-October to late December. And the birds started out at this higher elevation. And very serendipitously for the study, there was this huge storm that lasted for 10 days that occurred in mid-November. And after the storm, a lot of these birds had moved down to the lower elevation. What the researchers did was throughout the course of the study, they actually captured these birds and took some blood from them to measure the level of stress hormones in their blood. And what they found was that the stress hormones were much higher on rainy days than they were on non-rainy days. So the birds were getting a lot more stressed out when it was raining outside. And they were also overall tending to move to these lower elevations as the months went by and these higher elevations were getting a lot more rain.
Why do researchers think the rain is stressing them out?
Well, Rob, in addition to stress levels, the researchers also saw signs in these birds' blood that they were burning stored fat, a sign that they weren't getting enough food. And this also correlated with a heavy rainfall. And so the researchers' idea is that when it rains really hard, it's impeding the ability of these birds to find food, especially the smaller males. And the birds really start freaking out. They're saying, I'm not getting enough food, or I'm not going to be able to get enough food. I really need to move to a different location where I may be able to find more food.
Might this be true of other birds besides the white ruffed manakins?
Well, Rob, there are a couple thousand species that are what they call altitudinal migrants throughout the world. You know, these birds that migrate from higher to lower elevations or vice versa. And it's not clear what the researchers found in this study is going to be applicable to all of them.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of altitudes, this last story is about what's happening at very high altitudes on the planet Saturn.
What's happening?
Well, what's happening, Rob, is there's this very unusual shape known as Saturn's hexagon. This is a giant six-sided figure over Saturn's north pole.
What's causing it?
Well, this hexagon is actually made up of a jet stream. If you look at a photo of Saturn, you'll see various bands wrapping around the planet. And all these bands are part of the jet stream. But if you look at the North Pole, you'll see that one of these bands is not a circle. It's a hexagon. And researchers first noticed this in 1988 when the Voyager spacecraft made a pass over Saturn. They said, that's really unusual. You usually don't see geometric shapes like that. And it's been a mystery pretty much ever since. One of the original theories was that when Voyager first spotted this hexagon, it also saw this storm-like vortex near the hexagon. And they thought, you know, maybe like, you know, like a rock that may disrupt the flow of a stream in a river. This vortex was somehow disrupting this one jet stream and making it form a hexagon. But when Cassini passed by Saturn in 2006, the vortex wasn't there anymore, but the hexagon still was. So clearly there was something else causing it.
Did these planetary scientists ever consult a fluid dynamicist?
Well, as far as I know, they didn't, Rob, but fluid dynamics seems to be the potential answer to the riddle here. And the way researchers figured that out was they said, a group of physicists said, you know, can we somehow recreate this hexagon in the lab? And what they did was something actually very simple. They took a 30-liter cylinder, filled it with water, and placed it on a spinning table. And this spinning table created sort of like what you would see these jet streams around Saturn. You would see, you know, almost these circular bands around the outside of the cylinder. But then what they did was they added a small ring to the cylinder that whirled inside the cylinder at a different rate that, at which the cylinder was spinning. And so this ring created its own independent stream, which the researchers were able to follow with a green dye. And you can actually see a really cool video of this on the site. And what the researchers noticed was that the faster this ring spun relative to the rest of the cylinder, it started to create a variety of different geometric shapes. And eventually, it created a hexagon. And so what the researchers think is happening is that this particular jet stream over Saturn's north pole is moving at a rate relative to the rest of the planet that it's just optimized for creating this hexagon pattern that all the other jet streams that surround the planet are not creating.
Has this kind of thing ever been observed on a planetary scale before, though?
Well, oddly enough, such polygonal formations like this have actually been seen in hurricanes, again, where you have these strong sort of circular forces going on. And what the researchers say is, you know, even in a lot of fluid dynamics experiments that are done every day in the laboratory, you see stuff like that. It's just that the fluid dynamicists and the astronomers had never really gotten together before. And finally, they are in this study. And even though this study doesn't actually prove this is actually what's going on Saturn, it's the strongest clue yet that may help finally solve this cosmic mystery.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the physics of crowds. What makes crowds so hard to push your way through? And also a story about a new compound that appears to help cancer drugs have a much easier time getting into tumors. So potential applications there for cancer therapy. And for Science Insider, Science Policy Blog, we've got a story about Obama's new nuclear policy and also a story about the Chilean earthquake that happened a couple months ago, the very, very strong earthquake that struck southern Chile and what its impact has been on Chilean science. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.